This is Confessions of a Book Collector. I'm your host, David Headley, and I'll be exploring all aspects of publishing and book collecting, interviewing best-selling and upcoming authors, and sharing insights on inspiring books, both new and old. Welcome back to Confessions of a Book Collector. I'm delighted to be back again to talk with another author, an author that actually is one of my favourite writers. And I say this a lot, but actually there are some amazing writers writing today. My new guest wrote an extraordinary debut novel that was shortlisted for the Glass Bell Award called Blood and Sugar, and the author of that is Laura Shepherd Robinson. Laura Shepherd Robinson, welcome to Confessions of a Book Collector.
Thank you for having me on.
So nice to see you. Obviously, your new book has just been published, Daughters of Night in paperback, which is also an extraordinarily brilliant book. And I want you to tell the readers about both of those books. But I just want to congratulate you because you've done incredibly well. Your two books are amazing. And I have no idea where you're going to go next, but they are just extraordinarily brilliant books. And you are such a talented writer.
Oh, thank you. I'm blushing now.
So Blood and Sugar is your debut. Tell us a little bit about that. And how did that come about, that novel? Why did you want to write that particular novel?
Well, I've always been fascinated by the 18th century, and I knew I wanted to write a book that was set in the 18th century. I also come from a political background, and I guess it was kind of inevitable that I would want to write about one of the biggest and most hotly contested political issues of the 18th century, which was the transatlantic slave trade. And there are some absolutely wonderful novels out there about the Atlantic slave trade. I particularly wanted to focus upon the British end of the slave trade, the way that the British state and many of the most powerful people within the British state profited from that trade and defended it politically and ideologically for so long. And I wanted to consider that experience, but also the experiences of the men and women, black and white, who came together to try to outlaw and abolish the transatlantic slave trade. And that was really the starting point for my novel. But as I'm such a big fan of crime fiction, it was kind of inevitable again that I think that was the sort of prism through which I choose to tell that story.
And you do it so brilliantly and with great humanity. It's just beautifully, beautifully written. I remember having lunch with your editor, Maria Raitt, and Maria had just bought your book and she was so keen to tell me about it. And she said, it's not going to be ready for a while because I have to do some editing. But I remember her telling me and so passionately about your book, and I was desperate to read it. And then about 6 months later, it arrived on my desk and I was so excited about it because I remember Maria has bought some extraordinary books in the past. And I remember her telling me about C.J. Sansom's debut, and I remember her telling me about many. So I know that when she's telling me about a book, it's something really incredibly special. And Blood and Sugar is an extraordinarily special book. And so anyone who is a customer of Goldsborough will know that we did this beautiful black-sprayed edition of your book, and the cover is stunning. And I remember seeing very early covers and not being overawed by them and feeding back my comments to your publisher, which they took on board. But you were happy with that, weren't you?
Oh, absolutely. Delighted. It was stunning. Yeah, really stunning.
And how have you felt now that you've got a second book published, Daughters of Night, which we'll talk about in a minute, but how easy was it then to go on to write a second book? Because they're not series, not entirely series.
Yeah, they're sort of a loose series. So I describe them as being books that are complementary to one another because they can be read in any order and they have a different main character in each. In the first book, my main character is a man called Captain Harry Corsham. And he's a member of parliament, a former soldier, and he's in quite an unhappy marriage for reasons that I won't go into in too much depth because I don't want to give anything away. But he's in this quite unhappy marriage, and Caro, his wife, was a character that I really fell in love with while I was writing Blood and Sugar. And initially I had probably twice as many scenes with her in, but the plot of that book, it just didn't quite justify those scenes. And so you know, with a heavy heart, I cut them. But instead, I decided to give Caro a book of her own, and Daughters of Night is that book. And, you know, naturally enough, with Caro as my main character, I wanted to kind of explore this unhappy marriage from her side as well. And a big part of that is the constraints that were placed on women during the 18th century, and that really became the theme of the novel, because it's about the experience of women's lives in Georgian England across all aspects of society.
And ashamedly, I didn't actually know very much about the Vauxhall Pleasure Gardens.
You didn't know much about the Vauxhall Pleasure Gardens? I was stunning.
Obviously, I was aware of them, but I hadn't. I mean, you've clearly done a lot of research, and it was so enjoyable to read that I actually had to Google, and I went down a rabbit hole because I wanted to know more, and because you'd whet my appetite with this. But I didn't know how. I mean, I knew the Victorians were quite, you know, open, but this is pre-Victorian.
I think, if anything, the Georgians were more racy than the Victorians.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it was an age where certainly a lot of sex went on, and while certainly there were plenty of rules, as indeed there were in Victorian times, about how people should behave, as we all know, just because rules exist, it doesn't mean that everybody chooses to follow them. And so you had at the Vauxhall Pleasure Gardens, there was this sort of shady, unlit part of the gardens called the Dark Walk, and it was where people could go to meet their lovers, or indeed for men could go to meet a prostitute and, you know, whisk them off to these what were called the bowers, these little kind of sort of semi-concealed places where you could do whatever you wanted to do in the gardens at night. And the gardens owners, you know, in public would profess like shock that these terrible things went on in their gardens. But at the same time, they were very commercial men who knew that this was a huge part of the attractions of coming to Vauxhall. So they never actually did anything about it. They never put more lamps up in the Dark Walk. They kept it, they knew which side their bread was buttered.
Yeah. I know Vauxhall now as a present day place, and I know it's still got rooms that people go to, but that's a different story and we should move on from that. How do I know about this? Because people have told me. But tell me, Laura, what has your history research shown you about Vauxhall? Tell us more about Vauxhall.
So the Vauxhall Pleasure Gardens was about 20 acres of garden on the banks of the River Thames. And it started out as, you know, sort of like a beer garden, which we can all imagine. And gradually the owners got more and more ambitious in their plans. So there were art galleries there. There was circus acts that you could dine under the stars. There was dancing. Handel was a regular visitor there, and they would play Handel's music, and everyone knew the words. And Hogarth painted all the pictures in the supper boxes, which was where you would dine out, a sort of semi-sheltered little booths where you could dine under the stars. And it was incredibly popular, and it was also one of the first places where the classes mingled fairly freely. If you could afford your shilling to get in, the Prince of Wales would go, people would go to gawp at all these celebrities of their day. But also the sexes intermingled fairly freely there in a way that they didn't necessarily do in other social occasions. So it was considered a sort of very, very free and liberal kind of entertainment.
Sounds amazing.
Yeah, I think we should bring them back in the age of COVID.
Well, I think we should just bring them back.
Just bring them back, yeah.
Should be no more class. We should just have pleasure gardens everywhere. Anyway, the second book, if you're a book collector, you will know, or if you don't know, we did a special edition of your second book, a beautiful blue sprayed edged edition. They are available to buy. I think we may have a couple left on our website. But I've seen the paperback has just been published, and you've got two special edition paperbacks.
I know, I'm very spoiled. They're very beautiful. There's a special edition for the independent bookshops, and there's also a Waterstones special edition.
Amazing. And they do look beautiful. And you have been, you've won a couple of awards, and you've been shortlisted for quite a number of awards for Blood and Sugar, haven't you?
I have, and also Daughters of Night has been shortlisted for the Historical Writers Association Gold Crown. which Blood and Sugar won the Historical Writers Association debut crown.
Amazing.
And it also won the Crime Fest and Specsavers debut novel award. So, it was lovely. Really thrilled to be recognised like that.
You are a fabulous writer. And what are you currently writing?
I'm writing a novel, which it's a historical novel, also set in the 18th century, but it's a standalone. It doesn't feature the characters from my previous two books. And it's sort of, let's say, more of a mystery than a full-on crime story, but still with a very rich plot. And it's a little bit sort of like Fingersmith meets, I don't know, Jonathan Strange, maybe. It's kind of wow. It's about fortune-telling and magic and trickery and a lost inheritance. And, yeah, I could talk about it for hours, but it hasn't been announced yet, so I better not, or I might get into trouble with my editor.
When's that due to be published? When do you have to deliver it?
So I can chase Maria to read it. I have to deliver it in June.
In June?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll put the first of June in my diary, and I'll email Maria to read it. It sounds fantastic. Actually, I do know a little bit more, because you've told me offline about it, but I am very excited to read it. It just sounds amazing.
Well, I've had a lot of fun writing it.
Great.
It's kind of set in Bath in London and Cornwall, the Bartholomew Fair. Takes place over a number of years, so it's a different sort of novel to the ones I've written so far. But yeah, I've absolutely loved it.
And how easy has it been to write?
That's a good question. I mean, I always wrestle with my books because they have to be just right. I'm one of those people that I can't just do something that's okay. I have to wrestle with it until I'm 100% happy. So they're always a little bit of torture, but torture of a very pleasurable kind.
And you can't tell us the title?
I better not, I'll get in trouble. Maria will tell me off.
That's all right, I'll ask. Okay, well, this is the point in the podcast where we take you to the confessional and you come and confess all your sins and virtues of books that sit on your shelves. I know that you're a big reader because we've spoken about this, and I know that you collect books because I have visited your place and I've seen that you've got a wall full of books. But what are your very special books? What are the books that inspired you to want to be a writer, or as a child, what encouraged you to read? What books stand out to you?
I was a really voracious reader as a kid. I was always like sneaking off and I'd hide like behind the sofa or wherever and be read so that I couldn't be made to do any like jobs around the house or go out for a walk or something awful like that, and instead I'd be reading. And I loved Joan Aitken's books, the Wolves of Willoughby Chase series when I was a kid, which probably was the first time I read historical fiction. I also love the books of Diana Wynne Jones. She lived opposite me, actually, where I grew up in Bristol. And she wrote these wonderful books about magic and, you know, witchcraft. And on Halloween, we would call at her house and it would be like decorated amazingly. And that she would have all these things for the children to do. And so everyone around me read Diana Wynne Jones's books. And they were fantastic. And I'm really pleased that they've kind of become sort of classic children's books now. So that was what I read as a kid. I didn't think about becoming a writer until I was probably about 30 when the idea first came to me. But I think the book that really rekindled my love of fiction as opposed to non-fiction, which I read a lot in my late teens and early 20s, was a book called An Instance of the Finger Post by Ian Pears, which was a sort of murder mystery, but a very, very clever one. And it's set in Restoration England, so just after the Civil War. And it is one of the most exquisite pieces of storytelling that I've ever read, beautifully written. And I've been reading a lot of non-fiction books about the 17th century, and I was actually in a bookshop and I saw this book and I thought, oh, that, you know, that would be interesting to read alongside. And I learned so much more about the passions and the emotions that drove the Civil War from reading that book than I did from any of my non-fiction. I actually felt I had a much better understanding of the period, and that was a real kind of lesson to me in terms of the power of historical fiction. And so that was one of my favorites.
And I don't want to interrupt you, but it's so remarkable because I love that book so much. And on my last episode of the podcast, I spoke to Erin Young, and we obviously both love that book. So it's so remarkable that another person has mentioned that.
I mean, it's wonderful. I read it so many times. And subsequently, when I did decide that I wanted to write a novel, I read it again several times, just trying to work out what Ian Pearce had done. I mean, he's a wizard. It's wonderful.
He owes us money, I'm sure, by now. The royalties he must be making from the sales. Or his publisher should be advertising. But yeah, that book is so amazing. Anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but it's just so remarkable. Yet another person has mentioned that. I think it's been mentioned 3 times on this podcast since we started it. Yeah.
How incredible to have written a book that has inspired so many other authors to go and write. I think that's probably a real, you know,
I've never met him. He's one author that I've never met that I'd love to meet.
Well, I raved about his book on Twitter. And then he emailed me. This was in the first lockdown. He said, "When lockdown's over, let's go for lunch." But I haven't done that yet.
Right. So. Well, say hello to him from me.
But he was incredibly nice and very generous.
I saw him. He was shortlisted for a CWA Crime Writers Association Historical Dagger quite a while ago, and I know he was present. I don't think he won. And I'm not even sure which book it was for. But I knew he was there, but I never got the chance to meet him, and I'm sad about that, but I would have just done what you've just done, is wax lyrical about his brilliant book.
Good old fanboy.
Yeah. Well, I do that quite a lot. Even now, you know, I've been in this industry for 25 years now, and I still meet authors. I think of when I first met you. When you read a book and you meet the author, generally, it's like meeting like a famous movie star. I'm just so, I wax lyrical and I fanboy the people, and I think they all think I'm a bit crazy, but actually it's because I'm so passionate and I don't think
any author ever thinks someone who thinks their book is wonderful is crazy.
I think I remember in my first episode I was interviewed by S.J. Watson, and I remember telling him about this author called Candace Robb, who wrote brilliant historical novels, crime novels set in York, and because I'm from York, I was very passionate about those books, and I saw her coming out of Hatchards and Piccadilly, and I recognised her from the photograph in her book, and I chased her down the street, and she was mildly horrified that I recognised her. She said, "I didn't look like that photograph," but and then I just told how amazing her books were, and I hope that she was touched by that rather than just thought I was a freak.
I'm sure she did.
But her books, anyway, if you are a massive fan of historical fiction, medieval fiction, then Candace Robb is another author that I would highly recommend. Owen Archer mysteries are extraordinarily brilliant. Anyway, back to you. Well, so what other books have inspired you, or what other books recently have you read that are amazing?
So probably the two authors that I love in terms of their prose as well as their plots are, in the first instance, Hilary Mantel. I think Wolf Hall is an absolute masterpiece of a book.
Well, I know from Twitter you've read that more than once. You've read it twice or 3 times.
I did, because when you came round and you saw my copy of Wolf Hall, it was a hardback copy, and it was like you just saw quite how
I was horrified as a book collector. And
David kind of went pale and went, "Tell me that's not a first edition," and insisted on opening this up. And luckily it was a second edition, because I don't think he would have coped. Because I took it on holiday, it probably fell in the pool, it's covered in suntan lotion, the cover's hanging off. Anyway, that's a testament for me. The condition of a book is a reflection of how much I've loved it. And I love that book very, very much. I don't think there's anyone better at writing historical fiction than Hilary Mantel. Just her language, the world she conjures, it's just all absolutely wonderful. I read any page of a Hilary Mantel book and my heart kind of sinks, because I'm like, might as well just give up now.
So you're a fan of A Place of Greater Safety?
Yes, I love that. Yeah. I think it's a very, like, you can tell how much she grew as a writer, but at the same time, I think that raw energy and power in A Place of Greater Safety is just, you know, I read that over, I think it was just after Christmas, like for sort of the 3 days after Christmas, and I read it, and it's a very big book. And I think it took me about a week to come down from the French Revolution and all the passions and emotions. And I mean, well, you know, I felt kind of traumatised. I felt like I'd been through the French Revolution.
Yeah, it was certainly a flag of what was to come.
To come, yeah.
Because she's such an extraordinary writer.
And the other author who I have probably read more than any other and who I absolutely love is John le Carré. And I think what he did so wonderfully, I mean, he's by far from the only author that's done this, but he's probably the one who's done it on the biggest canvas. He proved that it's perfectly possible to write wonderfully plotted genre fiction and at the same time have beautiful prose and fleshed out characters that are at least as good as anything you'll find in literary fiction.
Yeah. He never wanted his books submitted for any prizes.
He didn't, no. He
surprised, because he would have won so many, I think.
Yeah, I think, I'm not sure whether that was true at the beginning of his career. I think maybe we've slightly relaxed in our attitudes to genre fiction. I hope we have anyway. But I think he certainly felt that there were elements of the literary establishment that were quite snobby at the idea of spy novels being considered worthy of the canon. So
I'm going to be controversial and say there's quite a lot of snobbishness still in publishing.
I'm sure there is. I'm sure there is.
My experience is that there's still quite a lot of snobbishness. But he was a brilliant writer. He was a very good friend to Goldsborough. He always used to come and sign, and we'll miss him. He was such a charming man. But yeah, he's such a wonderful writer. What's your favourite book by him?
I mean, Tinker Tailor, Soldier Spy is an absolutely fantastic novel. It's so exquisitely plotted, and the characters. It's very political book, but it's also such a human book. And the way he weaves the theme of betrayal throughout that book, I think is really beautiful, and I learned an awful lot from reading it and rereading it. I think Smiley's People is also a really wonderful book. It's obviously the third one in the trilogy, of which Tinker Tailor it is the first book. And it's probably a slightly more conventional, I want to say detective novel, even though it's a spy novel, because he is unravelling a mystery in the course of it. I think they're both wonderful books, but I think probably I'd have to say Tinker Tailor has the edge for me.
Right. And I also loved A Constant Gardener.
Mm.
I really loved it. I remember when that was published, and I devoured it, and he clearly knew what was going on in the world. I mean, he was very attuned to what was going on in the world.
Yeah, and felt very passionately about it, and sometimes very angry about it, and that really comes through in his books. And what I think he captures so well is, the on the one hand, the emotion, like he wasn't afraid of saying, you know, this is wrong, and being very emotional and passionate about it, but at the same time he never lost sight of the complexities, even if the emotional response was a simple, powerful one. And so I think his ability to balance those two is one of the great strengths of his writing.
I know that you do read, because you tweet quite often about some of the books that you've read. What recent books that have you read that you absolutely loved?
So I loved Joseph Knox's latest one, True Crime Story. I'm a really slow reader. I don't read as much as I'd like these days, and the reason is because if I read a book that impresses me, I read it really carefully to see if I can work out how the writer has done what they've done. It's, you know, writing has slightly ruined reading for me in that respect, because I find it so hard these days to just lose myself in a story. Now, that book by Joseph Knox, True Crime Story, I lost myself in that story. I don't think you could not lose yourself in the story. It's just so gripping. I read it over 2 days. My husband still called me a slow reader because he read it in one.
It's absolutely fabulous.
And a clever idea. I can see it right behind your head, but that's not the reason I'm saying it. Stuart Turton's book, The Devil in the Dark Water, that was fantastic. I really thoroughly enjoyed that. I read Erin Young's book, The Fields. I really enjoyed that, which is not historical fiction. It's set in the Iowa cornfields. It's a contemporary crime story. So I loved that.
Okay, so here's a question, and I asked this of Erin Young, actually, and I haven't asked it before, but I'm going to ask you, just to put you on the spot before we finish. You have to leave your house. You have to take one book with you. What from your collection would you take?
I'd be tempted to take all four, but I think I would take a book that actually, in some ways, I think there are similarities between It and Awful, which is Middlemarch, which is a novel I absolutely adore. And I've read it many times, and it's that world that is created in Middlemarch is just so convincing and so wonderful and so political and yet so human. And, you know, any novelist who can make you lose yourself in a period like that, it is truly one of the greats. And also, it's a really long book, so it would keep me busy while I'm waiting for my house to be rebuilt.
I have never read that book.
David, you must. It's wonderful.
I don't know why I've not read that book. Anyway, people are probably judging me now. Laura, I just want to say to you, I love spending time with you. I love chatting to you. You are an amazing writer. And if you're listening to this podcast, can I just urge you, just go and buy Blood and Sugar or Daughters of Night, or if you can afford to buy two, go and buy both of them, because I promise you, you will not be disappointed. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been lovely.
Subscribe now and follow Goldsborough Books on socials to keep up to date with our latest news and to learn who will be joining me on Confessions of a Book Collector, your new favourite podcast.